Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Back here on Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game on this Monday morning. We were just talking about Long Gone Summer, the 30 for 30 that the three of us watched last night on ESPN, and somebody who was featured in this, pretty prominent in that 30 for 30, was Bernie Miklas, and he is on the line with us. He was the longtime sports columnist at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He has been on the scene, the sports scene in St. Louis, for a very, very long time, and he is on the line with us. Bernie, how you doing?
I'm doing good. And you could have just saved some time and just say he's old.
I would never do that. Are you kidding?
No, I'm just kidding. It's good to be with you guys. Thanks.
Well, thanks for doing this. Let's just start with what you thought of the 30 for 30 last night overall.
I thought AJ, the director, did a really good job of synthesizing a lot of stuff, because there's so much stuff. Not only this epic entertainment spectacle of this home run chase, which baseball needed, and then you have the aftermath of, you know, performance enhancing drugs and how we should look at it. And I mean, there's a million things in there, and he talked to a million people, it seems, and which was good. He's really thorough. And I got to imagine that it would have been tough to edit that thing and just to boil it down to less than 2 hours running time. But I thought he got it. I thought that he nailed it. And I say that as someone who covered that home run race in 98 and virtually every day, like starting in June. And, it was an extraordinary thing to cover at the time. So I appreciate, on a personal note, I mean, I just appreciated some of the memories and watching some of that stuff last night. It brought back a lot of things that made me smile.
Yeah, I had moved here. That was my first full year and summer in Nashville in 1998, and I had moved here from Cleveland, Ohio, covering the Cleveland Indians, 95, 96, 97. So some really good years in Cleveland, and 94, the shortened season. And now I'm in Nashville, and we don't have a Major League Baseball team, but obviously there's a huge amount of baseball fans in this market, and it has grown a lot more 22 years later. So I was no longer in that world. I did see Mark McGwire come through at Jacobs Field in 97 and hit one off the Jumbotron, which most speculate it's well over 500 feet. But you lived it, Bernie. What was it like? And, you know, when Mark McGwire talked about being a caged animal, that obviously was a big deal. It seems like he was very surprised that those comments, you know, got so much pub.
You know, one thing that was brought out in the 30 for 30 last night, and it's 100% true, Mark McGwire, for as big as he became in terms of a baseball celebrity and the focus of attention, he never was comfortable with it. But that's true of when he was a young player. That's true when he was hit 49 home runs as a rookie. He was not a limelight guy. He was almost, I'd hate to say bashful, but reticent. He liked other people out in front. He just wanted to go to work every day. So he really was genuinely uncomfortable with all of the hype and all of the hysteria over this, because he was the center of attention. He and Sammy, Ken Griffey, you know, they were being elevated to, McGwire was being elevated specifically to a place he had never been before. And everywhere he went, it was a circus. You know, he'd go into places like Miami and Pittsburgh that didn't draw flies. And there's hundreds of people lined up outside the ballpark just to get a glimpse, hopefully an autograph, when he would arrive in a cab or whatever. And those places which wouldn't draw people to games were like filling the place for batting practice. So he not only had the pressure of performing in the games, chasing the record, also holding off Sosa, he had the pressure of putting on a show every day, as tired as he may have been, to put on a big show in batting practice, which became almost like, you know, a doubleheader, batting practice, then the game. And his mental strength in this, that whole summer, to me, was the most impressive thing about him, because he nearly lost his you-know-what a few times, where he just became overwhelmed by it and frustrated and he kind of lashed out. And in fact, I would tell him maybe media people shouldn't talk to an athlete. I said, look, man, you gotta go with this. The media's not going away. The fans aren't going away. So you need to make the best of it. You ain't doing yourself any favors. And I think, you know, I'm not the only one who told him that, but certainly. And I think he took it to heart. Once he had decided to try to have as much fun with it as he could, he relaxed and things got better. But it was really tough for this guy. And I can testify, like, not only just at ballparks and hotels, but we would happen to wind up at the same place for lunch or have a same place after a game to have a beer, and just by accident, wasn't planned or anything. And, you know, even then, it's just like he's, you know, sitting down for a lunch and just getting swarmed. And he just wasn't used to that. So it was a tough adjustment for him. And to his credit, it made what he did more impressive, because that part of it was something he had never gone through before.
Bernie Miklas on the line with us. It feels like Mark McGwire was featured a lot more than Sammy Sosa. And, you know, one of the conclusions that I came to is, it seemed like, and we were talking about this in the first segment of the show, and I want to get your take, Bernie, is McGwire has since come clean. He's openly talked about it, and he has been still very active in the game of baseball. Sammy Sosa is, and Willie used a great example, is kind of taking the Lance Armstrong approach. Well, you know, everybody was doing it, so you had to do it. Everybody was doing it. Why are you focusing on me? You know, and so he really hasn't come clean, and he hasn't been embraced or at least welcomed back as much as Mark McGwire. Do you buy that theory at all, or what do you make of it?
I think it's a really good theory. I agree with it. You know, Mark McGwire, as a condition of coming back to baseball as a hitting coach for Tony La Russa, and by the way, he was an exceptional hitting coach, just really, really terrific. But a condition of that is he had to come clean, and he was ready to come clean anyway, to confess to everything and to be upfront about it and basically go through his apology tour or his confessional tour. And I'm not trying to be glib there. I mean, and it was really hard for him to do in a way. He had to live with that for a long time. He felt bad. He didn't think he was doing anything wrong at the time. But he just realized it had to be done, not for cynical reasons. It was two reasons. He had to do it to come back to work in baseball. But this was a burden that was on his back for a long time. And I think, as a sincere guy, he just felt it was time to just get it out there and just throw that boulder off his back. And whatever people say, they'll say. Sosa's always been, you know, kind of, you know, dodging it and making jokes about it. And we saw last night. And by the way, I'm not slamming Sosa at all. I mean, he's doing what he thinks he has to do. But, you know, even when they testified before Congress, which was a disaster for just about everybody there as far as the players, you know, McGwire, whatever he said, like, he said it and he meant it. And Sosa, in effect, kind of, you know, acted like, well, he can't speak English very well. He had his lawyer, like, you know, in effect answering questions from reading his statement. So even then, it's like, and look, I covered Sosa enough to know he speaks fine English. You know, it's like, so there, you know, there's always a little bit of, he was always some gamesmanship there. And I also think maybe I'm wrong about this, and I'm sorry to go on and on, guys, but I think that, say what you will about McGwire, and there's no doubt he used performance-enhancing drugs because he said so, but he always had power. I mean, he had 49 home runs as a rookie. He had power every – he set home run records at USC where steroids, PEDs were nowhere, you know, on the horizon, let alone in play then. So he always had the power. Sosa was a skinny little kid that was kind of amazing. All of a sudden, you know, becomes this home run monster. And it's just like – so I do think that maybe that weighs into it as well, even though both of them went to the PEDs for different reasons. The one guy we knew could hit home runs because that's all he did his whole time in the major league. That's not true of Sammy Sosa. And I'm just trying to explain the difference, because that might feed into what you're talking about.
Talking to Bernie Miklas, longtime St. Louis sports media icon. And Bernie, before we go forward here, I just want to wish you well in the next chapter for your life professionally, because I've been reading about what's happened in the last few months. We know the media landscape is changing, and I have no doubt you're going to land on your feet here. But We've always enjoyed your St. Louis perspective for many, many years here. We always know when we're reading about you, we know we're getting a really good look at what's happening in that city.
I appreciate it. And by the way, you know, the Blues and Predators rivalry is outstanding, and hopefully we will have hockey, and that'll be fun because that's a heck of a rivalry. I mean, I just enjoy that immensely. But I appreciate it. You know, not to talk about this too much, but, man, I've been in this game for 40 years, and, you know, since we're a real young guy growing up in Baltimore, and, you know, it took a pandemic, like the financial impact of a pandemic, to kind of knock me down the first time. So I've been very blessed. I mean, it's a very, as you guys know, we all know, it's a very, very volatile business, even during good times. But I'll be back. I've got some good options on the way and just have to sit out for a while. But it's I appreciate the sentiment. Thank you so much.
Well, Bernie, this will be an important perspective to get from you because I found myself as I watched this, you know, thinking, you know, I had shelved a lot of my thoughts about this because of the, as Bob Costas put it, the authenticity of the whole thing being questioned. And so I was swept up in it like all of us were. And then I tried not to think about it a lot because it was just in a different place. But, you know, this kind of helped me kind of get it going again mentally as to where to put this in history. So how do you find it now that we're 20 years removed, 22 years removed?
I think your perspective is pretty normal in that. I mean, I went through that myself. I went through the whole cycle of emotions and reactions. All right. First of all, I'm covering it every day. I'm caught up in the excitement. It was amazing to actually cover that every single day because it was such a national phenomenon. That's number one. Number two, then we all suspected. I mean, everybody had to say, well, is this on the up and up? You know, there's home runs all over the place. What's going on here? I think we knew something was going on, but it's not like the players who weren't using at that time were willing to sort of point fingers. It was sort of everybody's just sort of protecting the business. Business is good. Business is booming. The owners love it. The players love it. There's selling tickets galore, people buying souvenirs, people buying this, buying that. I mean, it was great for baseball when baseball needed it. Then I got angry. And when I say I got angry, and I really respected, and I still do, Mark McGuire. I really liked him. I think he's a really good guy. But then I got angry because there were so many times I talked to him, and he just denied using steroids, this and that. And then when he came clean, and I was like, you know what, man, gosh, you know, I feel betrayed. You know, I sort of took it personally. I think a lot of people did. We covered this. We defended you. We elevated you. You deserved it at the time because you were doing remarkable things and the whole nation was riveted by it. But then when I think we all felt this sense of guilt almost, like, because we were part of that, of the, you know, propping this thing up. And then as the years went by and you saw all of the debates about Hall of Famers and you see guys shifting their standards about who to vote for and you see, you know, you go back and realize how much players relied on amphetamines, which is absolutely a performance enhancing drug. And you realize that we're technically speaking, as I mentioned in the documentary last night towards the end, there were no collectively bargained rules against using any of that stuff at that time. And the androstenedione, Dione, for example, a grandmother could have gone into GNC and bought it. I mean, it's really so. I'm like, well, why are we demonizing these guys when steroid use was rampant in the game at that time? It was the wild, wild west. There were no rules. It was sort of like every man for himself. Hey, I think that pitcher's. Hey, if that pitcher's using it, I'm going to use it. I want to. You know, I'm not going to let somebody have a competitive advantage over me. And I thought one of the reasons why there was such a backlash to it, and I'm not blaming anyone who really was revolted by this when the truth came out. But there was also an assumption that players of yesteryear would have never done something like this. That's BS. You know, players through history have taken every advantage that they could if they thought it would make them better. And Bob Gibson himself in an interview said, when he was asked, would you have done that had steroids been available at your time? The great Bob Gibson said, look, I'm not going to let anybody have a competitive advantage over me. If that was going to put me on equal ground, yeah, you're damn right I would have done it. And so I sort of tried to take the whole moralizing about, hey, yesteryear's players were honorable and noble and all. You know, I tried to realize that that's kind of poppycock. Because we don't know what those guys would have done back then. I think we do, because history tells us what they would have done. And I just kind of realized, you know, it's kind of silly to go back and try to relitigate all this and to demonize people. Baseball knew what was happening. Baseball let it go because business was good. These guys were cash cows. And now all of a sudden everybody wants to find religion. So I'm really at peace with it. I enjoyed covering that thing. I apologize for nothing, because it was a flashpoint in time, and it reflected that era. Just like there have been all kinds of eras during Major League Baseball, some of which have been embarrassing. So just put this on the history file. No one was a demon. They reflected what was going on in a rampant way during the game. Sorry for the long speech there.
No, I think we've all had these emotions and thoughts as we've tried to process this, especially if you love the game, like all of us on this show absolutely do. So, Bernie, as we look back on it, I think more, and I try to remember the power of the Players Association, right? It was not easy to get stuff done, but you would have to have thought, in retrospect, that everybody in baseball, and I would hope you could make a good case to the players, that, hey, you don't want certain players having advantages that others don't because they're using stuff like this. By the late 80s, early 90s, that would have been the time to try to introduce that thought and work through. And by 95 or 98, hopefully you could have had a system that had at least a level playing field that maybe couldn't weed out steroids, but avoiding what you said, which I thought was a central issue. It was the Wild West. There were zero regulations at all. So it just invited everybody to jump in. Well, all these other guys are doing it. I guess I have to do it or I'm going to lose my job. Do you feel like baseball is probably more responsible for that than the individuals that partook?
I really do, and I've had a lot of conversations with owners off the record, mostly because they don't really want to run their mouths. And this was back then, and in the ensuing aftermath. I'm not talking about right now necessarily, but they realized this was just great for the game, and baseball needed it. I'm not trying to be glib here, but baseball needed a performance-enhancing drug. Baseball needed a PED because baseball was really weak at that time because of the labor strike. But anyway, every Major League Baseball player at that time knew what was happening. No one spoke out against it. Look, I realize it's hard to be a whistleblower. I mean, look at what happened to Mike Fiers after the Houston Astros stuff when he spoke publicly about the cheating. It's not easy to step out. But I always thought, look, the guys who came out later and said, I feel like I was cheated. I feel like, you know, these guys took money out of my pocket. Well, easy for me to say, but you should have said something. Or better yet, go to your union and insist to talk to Major League Baseball about instituting real rules and drug testing, and then you don't have to worry about it as much. But no, players didn't do that. I mean, the players who may have disapproved of what they were doing, talking about McGuire and Sosa and countless others, they never took the initiative to try to reform it, and they had the power to do so by pressing their own Players Association. Didn't happen. Eventually it did because no one in the game had any choice. And it's just like the Hall of Fame, which is related. It's like my philosophy is, look, if these stats are valid, if these stats count, then don't ask me to be the cop. I'm not your policeman. If you want to invalidate those home run stats, then I won't consider the players. But don't ask me to be the policeman because you don't have the guts to do something to reform your game at that time. That's on you, not me. So the hypocrisy of all of this has always been something that's bothered me, and another reason why I eventually came to kind of reached a place of peace in my own view of it, because I don't like hypocrisy. And this whole issue is just drenched in hypocrisy, not so much now, but in the ensuing years after the secrets came out.
Bernie Mikulas is with us. You bring up hypocrisy, and I think what's interesting about not only baseball but sports in general is it kind of repeats itself in different ways with whether it's a scandal or good things too. But 1998, that home run race, and then what happened after with the steroid era and the steroid scandal, and then now you have sign stealing, which are two different things, but you also have similarities in Bud Selig. Everybody kind of figures he knew what was going on in his game. Rob Manfred, kind of figure he knew what was going on. When you look at both situations, though, when the history books are written, What do you think is more egregious, and people are going to ultimately look at those two commissioners and say, yeah, you were a little more egregious than the other one?
It's a great question and a difficult question, and I've given it some thought. And I think the way I came down on this, if I had to, there's so much gray area, obviously, and I know we live in a time where people don't want to see the gray area. It's all or nothing, and I still have a hard time operating that way. I'm a pragmatist at heart. But it's a situation where steroid use, I'm pretty confident saying this, was not orchestrated. It was not a team effort. You didn't have coaches showing players how to inject themselves or teaching them about, here, you got to take this, this will help you. It was never an orchestrated effort. It was basically, as we go back to that term, the Wild Wild West, everybody did what they thought they had to do. And, yeah, people knew about it, but it was not an orchestrated thing. It was not a planned thing. It was not an organizational plot, if you will. With the Astros, I think the thing that bothers people so much is, you know, first of all, you bring electronics into it. The old-fashioned sign stealing has always been a part of the game and always should be part of the game, where you pick up the other guy's signs. If they can't disguise their signs, that's their problem. But then to realize the extent of how orchestrated it was, it wasn't just a few individuals kind of going wild. I mean, you had coaches involved. You had team leaders involved. I personally think that's more egregious. But again, are we splitting hairs? We could be. It's a really tough situation. But I would side, if I'm taking a side, on the fact that the steroid era was pretty much individuals doing what they thought they could do, and they were allowed to do. Let's remember that again. They were allowed to do that. With the Astros scandal, it was. The fact that it was so widespread in terms of being orchestrated, I think was really bothersome. People that could have stopped it didn't. And maybe that's the one thing that both of these situations have in common. People that knew and could have perhaps taken action decided not to.
Do you think there's ever going to be a time where we go and we visit Cooperstown in the Baseball Hall of Fame and we see Mark McGwire or Sammy Sosa?
I don't think so. Look, I think the voters are younger now. They're turning younger, and I think they're more open-minded about recognizing the hypocrisy and the fact that this just represented an era, and you probably shouldn't compare that era and hold it against those players. They were the best of their era, just like other players have been the best of their era, including long times of segregation in baseball. But I think that now that those guys are off the ballot, and they'll be in the custody, if you will, of a committee. I just think there's still going to be a lot of people on those committees pushing back. I as we sit here today, I find it hard to believe they would get the committee support to get them in the Hall of Fame. I could be wrong, and maybe 20 years from now they will. But right now, as we sit here today, I'd be very skeptical of that.
As we wrap this up, Bernie, we traveled with the Predators in 2017 in preparation for round two, Blues, Preds. We get there the day before game one in the afternoon. We head over to Busch Stadium. We see the Blue Jays and the Cardinals. And if you remember, it was the game, the crazy play. Let's see if Willie could – Willie, do you remember the crazy play at home?
Oh, yeah, the flip.
Chris Coughlin.
The jump flip.
Jumps over Molina for that crazy slide at home. We were at that game. I never forget.
You call it a slide? I don't know if it was a slide.
Well, I guess he leaped over Molina and slid headfirst into home, didn't he? Or something like that. I mean, it was.
It was more of a flip than a slide, but it was effective.
It was.
It was not, you know, until you mentioned that, I hadn't thought about that probably since it happened. That's really funny. You heard me laughing when you were telling that, yeah.
It went viral on Twitter quickly. It was crazy to see that video circulate in a hurry. And we all just kind of looked at each other like, did that just happen? Holy cow. Hey, go ahead.
No, I know. It's man, there's so much great – it's been so many great baseball memories I've had just being a columnist and a talk show host here for over, a quarter century. It just seems so much and – you know, sometimes people tell me, hey, use your time off to write a memoir, tell your stories. And it's a great idea, except there's so many damn stories, I can't remember them all. Not because I'm squishy in the brain. It's just that so much has happened that I'd be afraid to, like, I'd miss something. I'd leave something out. So, yeah, it's been great to with the Cardinals and the Blues, and then we had that, you know, brief shining moment with the Rams. It's been fun to be here during this time, you know. So thanks for having me on. I mean, I really appreciate it. And look forward to the Blues and Predators going at it again in normal times, you know, once things get back to order. That's a great rivalry.
No
great
doubt about
town
it.
Too.
Well,
great
we've
hockey
always,
town.
Well, we appreciate that. Same to you guys. It's a fun rivalry. Best of luck to you with your next venture. We've always appreciated your work in St. Louis, and thanks for doing this.
Yeah, anytime, man. You need a St. Louis correspondent, I'm here. Thank you.
All right, Bernie, thank you. That is Bernie Miklas, longtime sports columnist for the Post-Dispatch. He's been on radio for many, many years there in St. Louis and knows the sports landscape, as you just heard, better than anybody in St. Louis. We will come back and wrap up the first hour of Darren, Donick, and Chase next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.